But the what happened at the end of the war? You were presumably in a gun position of some sort, were you?
Oh yes, we were.
We were dug in somewhere, and
yes, we'd been firing from the our last position. We'd actually fired and fought from there.
Yeah.
And then our the brigadier of our 8th Brigade arranged. One of the German soldiers or civilians came through the lines one night and said that the German commander was prepared to surrender all the forces in and around Emden, and apparently he was the commander of the entire area. So it was the next day that Brigadier Roberts went forward and up near Orch and took formal surrender from the German officer commanding up there. And then that was the end of it as far as we were concerned. But we still had an awful lot of work to do. We had to clean up the area, and there was mines and all over the place. We had to make sure that the civilians weren't armed. We had to, every house, every farm, every place had to be searched to get, and they all had hidden weapons, everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Germans were still coming from behind us to surrender. Drifting up, and in many cases they were starving to death too. So in addition to taking prisoners, we were also feeding them and looking after them. But we had no real problems. The odd SS guy would have to slap around a little bit because they're still pretty cocky, some of them. Actually, they were, you know, as it drilled into them, they'd been brought up that way. They were, some of them were absolutely mad dogs, you know. They had no mentality at all except to do as they were told and kill the enemy, you know. During that D-Day period, we had the Hitlerjugend, you know, against us. And they were the ones that slaughtered about 55 of the Canadian Scottish. Just put them up against the wall and shot them. And they were absolutely mad dogs. They had no intelligences of any kind except just kill, kill, kill. Matter of fact, if you took one of them prisoner, you if he had a grenade, he'd let it off and kill you himself with it. They were wasn't that General Myers? Was it?
Yeah, Kurt Meyer.
Kurt Meyer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was the bloke, you know. And mind you, I know to my own certainty that he had nothing whatever to do with this so-called atrocity, but he was made the goat of it. It was just the upbringing and the training of these Hitlerjugend. They were completely brainwashed.
Yeah.
And of course the SS, they were either that or in many cases they were the dregs of the country. I think some of them were actual criminals, you know. But the SS Panzer, the Panzer Division people, they were terrific soldiers, tremendously disciplined, but they were all fanatics, all fanatics. And you couldn't let up one instant with them.
So how long were you at just outside Emden?
Well, we were just there about not more than a week.
Mm-hmm. And then where did you go?
Then we came back into Holland at a little place called Lunteren. And we were there for a few days. And then we went to a place called Zeist. And we were there for several weeks. And then we moved back to Lunteren. And we were there until right till the end. We started forming then the 2nd, 13th. Regiment for occupation of Germany. We got the 2nd Regiment formed, but they never did go to Germany, because by that time Montgomery had found the Canadians were not susceptible to his kind of discipline. He found that they were rather inclined to like girls and
fraternize a bit,
and so he said no more Canadians, and that's the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
So we never did go. And I had to stay on. The colonel, I took over command of the 4th Light ACAC Regiment. and got it settled into Utrecht. And they had never had a proper mess, you know, they're independent batteries.
Yeah, they were all split up all the time.
All was split up,
yeah.
And they had a commanding officer who had no sympathy for the needs of his people. So I spent some time getting them established with a very, you know, with a decent sergeant's mess, a good gunner's mess, and good officer's mess. Then I came back to the 13th as commanding officer because Colonel Ostrander had volunteered for the Pacific. And consequently, he got back many, many months before I did.
He got back early, yeah.
And by that time, of course, the Japanese thing was over. So I stayed behind and I had to demobilize and get the fellows home. And I also had to go around settling up different little problems that the Canadian Army had left, such as babies and so on. And I forget how many I dealt with, but there was a Canadian commitment made in regard to this, that every child would be looked after until its 18th birthday, and so much money per annum, you know, to the mother and so on. And it was I had to check up, make sure that it was a good, legitimate Canadian baby involved.
Yeah.
It wasn't a Dutchman.
There weren't some Brits or Dutch in there.
Yeah, yeah. And then I also was in charge of handing over used equipment to the Dutch as gifts from the Canadian people. One thing that distressed me a great deal was that we had quite a few almost new vehicles, you know, Fords and Chevys and so on. We were not permitted to turn these over to the Dutch, only the used ones that, you know, that had quite a bit of wear on them. I found out later, I was told this later, that a lot of these new vehicles were taken out and dumped in the North Sea.
Hmm.
They didn't, in other words, they didn't want to destroy their market after the war. It was a terrible, terrible waste.
Yes, well, an awful lot of stuff was treated that way.
Yes, a lot.
All over the world, yeah.
It was done in this country, too, mm-hmm. in Canada. My brother, who was in Ordnance Corps here in Canada, saw the Americans bulldozing hundreds of brand new vehicles into the ground rather than take them back
mm-hmm.
or turn them over to the farmers and so on. And this was what happened over there. However, the one little interesting thing was that when we finished fighting, I must say that originally I'd told my people that when we went into action, the first thing to do was to write off as many things as possible lost by enemy action, so that you never ran out of things.
Mm-hmm.
Consequently, when we finished fighting, we were very much embarrassed because we had extra jeeps and extra 30-ton lorries and goodness knows what. In some cases, I was able to give these to the Dutch people, but their job, of course, was to change the identification on them as much as they could, mm-hmm. so they couldn't be traced. There was quite a problem.
You got into the used car business, or used car ring,
yeah,
eh?
I sure was.
Yeah. Yes, I suppose they had to do something pretty fast before somebody came along and claimed it. Right from under there.
We had one very, at Luntern, one day I was called to the divisional commander's office to be complimented on having the lowest venereal disease rate of any regiment in the British Empire.
I see.
And patted on my little head, you know, as how well we ran things, you know, in the regiment. And then I came back to the regiment and found that the fellows had set up a little house of their own in the forest nearby with six girls they'd recruited from Rotterdam, very nice girls too. And that's why we were so well fixed this way. And then about 2 days after I got back, the Dutch police raided the joint, and I was paraded then before the same divisional commander for running a whore house.
Oh dear. Well, you certainly had a good defense. It was pretty positive that it worked, eh? That the right...
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Yeah.
Well, everybody was happy with the, yeah, with the arrangement, and the girls were. They were getting good food, and they'd been given battle dress to wear, you know, and
steady clientele.
Yeah,
and, you know, yeah, good business all around, eh?
That's right.
Yeah, I'll be damned. Yeah. Well, how long did it take you to run down or wind up the regiment? And,
well, I didn't finish up until just about Christmas time, 1945.
Yeah, well, the regiment had gone by.
Oh, yes, they'd gone.
You were doing sort of...
I was left behind with quartermaster sergeant major, mm-hmm, and one or two staff, you know, in Lundgren by myself. And then when I... and the regimental sergeant major. And we went back to London. I got back to London in December of 1945, and I was within 10 days of my confirmation of rank. And the regimental sergeant major, who had also been promoted, he was within about 10 days of confirmation. And I remember going to military headquarters in London, and as I walked in, the adjutant said, take that pip off, chum, you're a major. And that's the way that the Canadian Army treats its soldiers. I told you before about how they reduced fellows in rank when they were wounded. And it's such a stupid way to run business, because it leaves a bad taste all around. The stories get around, and this doesn't help recruiting later on. You can hear tales of the First World War of the things that happened. One of the worst things that can happen in an army is that if you're overpaid, you have to instantly refund it.
Yes, right.
But if the pay corps owes a soldier money, my God, it might take 6 months before he gets his money. Mm-hmm. Everything works against the soldier. And with a volunteer army, it's absolute stupidity. Absolute stupidity. Now, in my case, as I say, I was within 10 days of confirmation of rank. Now, and providing that I'm not going to stay in the army, you know, in other words, there's no problem there. But there's countless and countless cases similar to mine. It made a tremendous difference to the gratuities paid.
Oh, yeah.
In other words, there are thousands of sergeant majors, you know, hundreds of them probably, and hundreds of officers in the same position that I was in, that were reduced in rank, mm-hmm, because they, in other words, the army had ceased to function. You were no longer with a regiment. You were just a transient officer, in other words. And you'd be reduced to your substantial rank. And in my case, that amounted to several thousand dollars.
Mm. Well, I can say it. See why you'd be upset, by gosh. Yeah.
Well, and after putting in 6.5 years, you know,
yeah,
away from home, and sacrifices the family made and everything else, you know, it's pretty short-sighted. But it seems to have been a concerted policy of the Canadian government, both wars, of niggardliness and stinginess, and unnecessarily so. We had to pay, I think I mentioned before in this interview, that we had to pay $4.47 for the pound. Mm-hmm. The Americans bought the pound for $3.86, which was the going rate. So we were paying a higher income tax than anybody in Canada.
That's why, of course, so many, or a lot of Canadian soldiers got into the black market, the money.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I remember meeting one chap who, a captain officer, who made himself a lot of money on the trading off dollars for guilders and changing it to pounds, you know, through the Americans, and then coming back and getting back again, getting $4 and 46 cents for it, and going around again. And
that's right. And then there's a question of flogging army supplies.
Mm-hmm.
This was the thing you had to watch for all the time. I mean, the temptation was there. The men were underpaid.
There was so much of it at the end that was surplus, that was just lying around.
Well, that's another thing, see. Yeah. We had a very good quartermaster, and he was always very careful to get as much out of the supply services as he legally could, or illegally, or anyway. So we always had extra rations, and they were available to be flogged, and I caught the cook several times, you know. And then the fellows were always picking up the odd thing, you know, like tools and, you know, if they're mechanically inclined. And when we first went into Holland, you could sell us one cigarette for 2 guilders. That's, at that time, that's, you're talking about a dollar a cigarette.
Mm-hmm. By the time you left Holland, was there anybody really left there, or were you one of the last by Christmas time? There could have been a great many.
There were just a very few left. Mm-hmm. Just a very few.
What happened to all the arms and the ammunition and a lot of it dumped, or the ammunition particularly, or what happened to all that sort of stuff? Any idea? Because it was all taken out of your hands long. Well,
most
early on,
most of the ammunition ended up in the North Sea.
Mm-hmm.
Just dumped. The rifles, the things of that nature, of course, were, I guess, I think a great number of it, of ours, would be turned over to the British
mm-hmm.
Army, and we turned over a lot of our guns and rifles and so on to the Dutch Army, Belgian Army, and yeah, she's in the bit. I think France got a lot of stuff,
mm-hmm.
quite a bit. And don't forget, we still had the Army of Occupation,
yeah.
Although we didn't take part in it to speak of. They still needed quite a bit of stuff for them. And what happened was that they would take a lot of the better equipment that we had, for instance, and then they'd dump theirs or sell theirs or give it away to the Dutch people, Belgian people, and French people. There's a lot of that went on.
Yeah, I'm sure there was, yeah. Well, that's very interesting. When you came back, were you demobilized in 46 then? Or?
I was demobilized in around February 1946.
Mm-hmm.
And put on the reserve of officers, and then I joined the 75th Regiment in Victoria as second in command in 1947. I took over command from Colonel Farnsworth and ended up commanding the 75th and the 5th Coast Regiment, and was commandant of the armories until about 1950, I think it was, about 1950, 51. Then again, the 75th was converted to a single battery, 5th BC Coast, no, 5th BC Field Battery.
Mm-hmm.
And so I turned command over to one of the majors and went on reserve officers, 1951.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was the end of your military career.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you joined us as a, what, an officer cadet?
No, I joined, actually, the 75th as a gunner.
Oh, yeah, actually. Yeah, but you went officer
yeah.
cadet and went up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And,
that's right. So both of us joined up as gunners.
Yeah. You got a little further than I did, but...
Well, just to say, no, Bill, I think it's very important. Now, I'd like to make this point. When I can still remember when I first took command of took command of a battery, for instance, and was in the position of meeting out punishments and, you know, the normal disciplinary and jobs. I think that the reason I was successful, and I was a very successful officer, was, I'm sure, because I had the training. I'd gone up through the ranks, right, from gunner up through sergeant major and so on, and I'd instructed as well, so that I knew all the excuses. I had to use them myself.
Mm-hmm.
And lost, I knew the temptations, I knew the problems that a gunner faced, and I think that I know that I was able to deal with men with complete impartiality and with a certain amount of sympathy that some officers didn't have and couldn't have. And in other words, I had a better education for looking after men than they had. Mm-hmm. And I've always said that the officers who come from the military colleges, they're either very, very good or they're bloody awful. There seems to be no medium there. And I think that one of the finest training grounds is to go through the ranks. I don't mean to sit there for years. I mean proper advancement.
Yeah.
I don't believe in this having another rank, you know, just suddenly become an officer after mm-hmm. 30 years as in other ranks, because that doesn't make a good officer. But I was very, very happy with as a commanding officer in any capacity, troop or battery or regiment. You know what the problems are. And you know from your own experience that if you hadn't had that experience, you'd never have been able to really understand what goes on in the ranks. Mm-hmm. And if you've had that experience, you can often stop trouble before it ever happens, because you can spot it before it gets up to a full head of steam. I enjoyed my time in the ranks, and I'm very, very glad that I had that experience, because it was very, very good later on in dealing with men.
Yes, right.
I don't know whether you've noticed it, but you see these American war films and everybody's saluting everybody else, you know. We never did any saluting in the field. No such thing.
No.
It was always a yes sir and a no sir. You know, there was no nonsense about it. But we were a good, happy family. And the 13th Field was one of the happiest regiments I've ever served with. They were a very, very fine bunch of men, and we had them. We had men from all walks of life and from all provinces, I'd say. French Canadians, we had French Canadians. We had Indians. One or two Negroes, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I never had a problem of a drinking Indian in all the time I was in service. The moment they left the army, they were back to the reserve and in trouble again. But when they were in the army and they were treated as equals, and they were absolute equal, they had the same food, the same dress, the same problems. We had no drinking problem with Indians in all the time that I served, in 6.5 years.
Yes, and that mm-hmm. the environment has a great deal to do with it then.
That's right.
Yeah.
In 1939, for instance, when we mobilized. As you know, it was before your time, but this was the Depression days when we had an awful lot of very angry young men. And I think the only thing that saved them was the war.
Mm-hmm.
They were so bitter and so deprived of it. They were in rags. And when they joined the army, they were equal. Everybody was equal. And we had a tough time the first couple of months with them, you know. But then they all settled down, and it was marvelous, absolutely marvelous. Wonderful spirit. The odd conscript that we got towards the we got them. The first ones came when we were at the Breskin's Pocket.
Mm-hmm.
Now the ones that came to the artillery were no training at all.
Oh, really?
Absolutely none at all.
That's funny, isn't it?
It was absolutely.
There certainly were artillerymen, trained artillerymen in Canada.
Well,
we didn't
get them.
Yeah,
they were kept here. We were fighting 25% under strength from about 2 weeks after D-Day, we were down to 75% strength.
Hmm.
And we fought that way right through, getting even worse. Some of our infantry battalions were down to 45% strength. And we couldn't get reinforcements. The Air Force had 500,000 people they didn't know what to do with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were letting him out of the service in that time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the conscripts we got, they were, of course, volunteer conscripts. There was nothing wrong with them, except they had lacked complete training. But the ones that the infantry got, it's a different thing. If you haven't got an infantryman trained and disciplined, then he's not going to stand up. Mm-hmm. He's going to run when it gets tough, and you can't depend on him. That's the big thing that keeps people, in the line is the comradeships, and the thing that built up the esprit de corps. Now, these fellows, of course, had no opportunity to get that. So that the infantrymen, when they got some conscripts there in Breskett's pocket, they were very, very low caliber. Until they'd been with a unit for about a month or so, and then of course they were all right. But it wasn't their fault. They'd never had proper training. And that's another thing, again, why I am so opposed to this so-called unification of services in this country. One of the biggest things that holds you in the line against the enemy is that you are a proud member of the Royal Regina Rifles or the Queen's Own mm-hmm. Rifles or the Canadian Scottish. You're not a bloody sailor going around in a sailor's uniform. One of the proudest things with us that we were members of the Royal Canadian Artillery mm-hmm. and our particular regiment. And I think that the most disastrous thing that happened in this country is this stupid so-called unification of services.
Yeah, and this is, of course, that's one reason why they, or not the reason, why they reduced the number of regiments in the Armed Forces to three, infantry, mm-hmm. from six, yeah. because there was so much cross-posting.
Yeah.
That they were losing that esprit de corps. You'd be a black watch one day and a
that's right
PPCLI the next,
and there was no incentive to join up.
That's right. So now they've got three battalions of each, and things are much better apparently.
Much
you
better.
You pretty well stay with your own yeah. regiment or battalion for the.
But for you still have that feeling.
You're stuck with the immigration part. Right?
Yes, you're going around. Yeah. You're going around like an unemployed bus driver.
Yeah,
that's what you look like.
Yeah.
That uniform is impossible.
But apparently that's why the QOR and the Black Watch and who was the other?
Well, the Highlanders.
Guards? Who was the other? Well, we were taken off the permanent roster.
That's right. The Grenadiers, the Grenadier Guards, or the
Canadian Guards, I think.
Canadian Guards, yeah.
And so that's why they had to they consolidated a bit in order to get this. Continuity of regimental service, and it seems to be. I was told the other day it seems to be working from that point of view, and they have to work within, within very strict boundaries on this unification thing.
Well, I think it's all wrong, and
yeah.
See, the Navy never gave in. They never. The Navy is still the Navy,
mm-hmm.
and the same badges, rank, same.
More or less.
Yeah. They still haven't got their uniform back. I mean, they haven't got their,
mm-hmm.
their old bell-bottom trousers and so on in the old days.
No.
But, I think it's a bay there.
The Air Force didn't seem to care. And they came out of it the best anyway.
Well, do
my
they?
God, they...
Yes, they... but they're a bit different. The Air Force is more individual. It's more, you're more individual.
Well, yeah, it's a different situation. But, I mean, they've got... Their staff system has been put in now for all the services, and they're...
Well, yes,
but
you never had the same thing. I mean, to move from one squadron to another squadron, there's no great change.
No,
you're still Air Force.
That's right.
You're a fighter pilot, or you're a this and that. You see,
mm-hmm.
but with a regiment, it's different. You belong to a certain regiment, and you have a pride. And
who was the fellow?
Thank you very much for your kindness in speaking to me, and it was very interesting.